Hi, my name is Chris Judd, and this is Uncommon.
Uncommon is a production by Neural, a unique digital agency. Neural specializes in content production in the areas that matter most to your content strategy across podcast production, video production, and social media. If you want to increase your conversion or grow your brand trust, head to neural.com to request a callback. That's NEURALE.com.
My name is Jordan Michaelides, and I'm the host of Uncommon, a show that asks the why on business, media, current affairs, and sport. If you like this episode, do leave us a written review on your podcast app, particularly if you're on Apple Podcasts, as it does help the feed work out. If you like this sort of content, find all previous guests, just head to neural.com/uncommon. For the full video, you can search Uncommon Show on YouTube. For social, you can keep up to date with behind the scenes at uncommon_show on Instagram. But with all that being said, let's get into the episode. My guests this week, obviously, CJ5, Chris Judd, 2 times Brownlow medalist, premiership captain at the West Coast Eagles, former captain at both the Eagles and Carlton, media commentator and investor. I was thinking about little one-liners, little things that we could go to get things started on the icebreaker. And I was thinking, what's sort of been your peak interview moment? Was it interviewing Beckham or having to sit next to Purple on a regular basis?
I think Purple. I do enjoy Purple's company. And he's not quite as good looking as Beckham, but yeah. There's a lot of substance there. So I'm going to go with Purple.
Yeah, good choice. No Steven Seagal films during this lockdown time at all?
No, we have watched some old classics. Actually, we watched The Princess Brides with the kids the other day, which I'd never seen. Beck had watched it extensively as a kid, but I'd never seen that. And that's a pretty good one.
Yeah. Well, what did you like about it? What was the rating you'd give it?
I think I'd give it a 7. There's some lessons in there for adults, some lessons in there for kids. So, I think it was a goodie.
Speaking of kids, what did you think you were going to be growing up?
I thought I was going to be a football player from...
How early?
As soon as I could remember, really. And that's not, I think most kids probably want to be either a sports star, a musician, or a firefighter, police, something in that bracket, or a lot of kids. So I was there probably at the age of 16, thought it was a live possibility. And didn't spend a lot of time thinking about what would happen if that didn't work out or what the other steps were going to be, or sort of the chips were all in. And from the age of 15, 16, I was almost living as a pseudo professional athlete, really, with pretty focused on what I wanted to do.
When at that age did that sort of realization happen? Was it how serious it became at that age?
It was just exposure to national carnivals. So, yeah, you were, from an early age, you're able to rank yourself against the kids in your local neighbourhood who you're playing sport against. But probably about 15 was the first time I got exposure to other kids all around the country playing football. Mm. And probably, felt I was able to weigh the probabilities as to if a career in AFL could be a chance, and decided I thought it could and went from it from there.
Was there any lessons, because I could imagine parents, just in my own experience, playing a high level of soccer, obviously not as high as yourself, but you can sort of see there's a lot of involvement from parents. They have to buy into, the regular Saturday, Sundays, taking you to training, all the other auxiliaries that come with a high level of sport. Do you still hold any sort of principal lessons from your parents, like directly or indirectly from that time?
Oh, I was, as you have kids of your own, you become acutely aware of how much work is involved raising kids. And my parents, I was lucky enough, were comfortable doing that without any complaining or without making me aware of how much work was involved at the time as a kid, which is, a nice way to grow up. And that probably was illustrated with my basketball career. So basketball was a game for some reason, my old man just really disliked, unbeknownst to me. And basketball, as a 9 and 10 year old, I was in the rep team, which would involve driving out from, you know, Sandringham to Kilsyth, Keilor, you know, Geelong, all over the state on a Friday night, you know, at the end of a busy work week. And I remember finally plucking up the courage to tell my parents I didn't want to play basketball anymore when I was about 11. And the old man was just jumping for joy. And I remember just having no idea that they actually couldn't stand basketball. And unbeknownst to me, didn't like driving around in peak hour traffic on a Friday after a long week at work. So I think I was lucky to have a childhood where those things were hidden from me, and was just really able to follow what I was most interested in.
It's funny how age and wisdom in hindsight will give you that sort of perspective view. I remember having a similar thing. I played soccer. My dad did not like soccer at all. Like him and his brothers all played high level of what was the VFA, and they had no interest. But I think about it in hindsight, and growing up in Bentley Brighton, I played for Sandy, and Sandy for some reason got relegated into sort of the Eastern Corridor. And so most of the time we'd be spending our Sunday afternoons in horrible weather in like the Dandenongs or Frankston or something like that, driving an hour from home just to go play a 90-minute game that he absolutely hated. And in hindsight, it's quite nice to realize those sort of things. I mean, you're pretty widely regarded as one of the best modern footballers. I think a lot of people will assume I'm interviewing Chris Judd and this whole podcast is going to be about football, but the reality is that your life has changed dramatically in the last, you'd say, 5 or so years. I was intrigued, you know, you used to speak a lot about how you didn't want to be known as the cliched footballer. You obviously had a very high ATAR finishing school. How early on did the intrigue of investing come along?
Well, at a very unsophisticated level early on. So I bought my first shares when I was 16. I got some money from the AIS for an academy I was a part of. Decided I would invest that, you know, together. Me and my old man would put our heads together and I'd invest that and then buy a car with the proceeds. So there was a lot of early exposure to it. My dad isn't a keen investor and has no real interest in money. And neither does my mum. My grandpa my dad's dad was a really interested stock investor. Actually, both my grandparents were. So there was some sort of lessons learned from there. So there was an interest in it, and being an AFL footballer from an early age, I had some money to invest, which is rare for someone in their 20s unless they've got rich parents. So there was some gradual exposure. And then as a 28-year-old, I met a guy in Perth who really taught me how to invest properly. And that was sort of a bit of a turning point. And, you know, then there was the decision post-football. I actually worked for a venture capital company for about 18 months as an analyst for them. But really leaving them and going out on my own was a big step change. And it's been good for a number of reasons. I mean, the big thing I've got out of it, particularly the amount of macro investing reading I get to do, is just an increased understanding of how the world actually works. And you know, the world is anxiety provoking for everyone, but when you can start to piece together some pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, that's an interesting journey. And you know, there's the idea of being right and making money, which is really exciting, but starting to piece together different parts of how the world actually works is been really enjoyable as well.
Yeah, because you had, what was it? It was called Juddy's Jive.
West Coast?
Yeah, West Coast.
Well, this is serious research, Jordan. Yeah, yeah. Going back to the Juddy's Jive stuff.
it's where was it? It must have been on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
Wikipedia is quite good for collecting a lot of info. And you talked on a bunch of different topics. I got a sense from that you just like seeing things as they are and unpacking what happens. And that's sort of where you excelled in special comments in AFL, and it was just, it just so happened that you had an interest in business, and it sort of paired really well into that, right?
Yeah, well, I'm curious about how the world works. I'm also really curious about human psychology, and you know, behavioral psychology is such a huge part of investing. But it also, you know, my main memory from Juddy's Jibe was how I remember writing an article as a 20-year-old saying that I didn't think footballers should be role models. And that essentially footballers aren't any different to anybody else. And, you know, you either do one or two things. You either say, yeah, footballers are better morally than everyone else and hence we're going to make them role models, or you accept that they're the same as everyone else and hence it doesn't make logical sense for them to be role models, which is a pretty unremarkable argument to make. But I remember just the backlash at the time was just enormous. And the outcome of that for me was, you know, my job was to play football. It wasn't to bat away media questions. So I ended up post that just deciding not to have strong opinions on things whilst I was playing because it was a distraction to what I needed to do and what the team needed to do.
But also it gives the media an excuse to distract you.
Yeah, but it was also very unique that in a day and age where, you know, diversity gets spoken about so often, just how uncomfortable so many people are with actual diversity of thought.
Yeah.
You know, they're very comfortable saying they want people to look different and everyone to be included. But the level of discomfort so many people have, and often those fighting for diversity have with ideas that are different to their own, was it's quite alarming, really, looking back, that even that was cause for outrage. But that's the world we live in. And unfortunately, it's only gotten more and more concentrated since then.
Yeah, you can sort of see that as a gateway to where we are now, at least politically. I don't know, I'm a big fan of Jordan Peterson, so I'm very aware of this sort of stuff at the moment. It's just it's super interesting, and you do wonder, I don't know when Juddy's Jibe was written.
That would have been about 04, I think, maybe 03 or 04.
Yeah, so it does make you wonder, like we as humans have these opinions of certain situations already, but imagine if you'd written that in the era of social media, what the response would have been like. As everyone gets whipped up into a frenzy, I feel like social media in particular really pours gasoline on something that already exists.
I think Morgan Housel is a finance blogger. Have you come across his work?
Yeah, I love him.
I mean, his idea that you've got the biggest inequality in terms of what labor versus capital we've ever seen. So people with assets have become increasingly rich from ultra low interest rates, and labor, you know, isn't receiving inflation due to a number of reasons: technology, globalization, aging demographics. So workers are really being left behind, and it's created an enormous inequality. And then that's happened at a time when we're more and more connected than ever before through social media, and at a time when you can compare how you're going to the branding that people put forward of how they're going, whether or not that's true or not.
Yeah.
And that's a really horrible combo. So a whole heap of workers are being left behind. And you know, you mentioned Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson's always really focused on inequality of opportunity versus inequality of outcome. The thing about this inequality, it is unfair because it's born out of ultra-low interest rates that are kept artificially low by central banks. So that is something to complain about and is a justifiable gripe. I'm amazed that the left don't hold on to it and explore it, and they'll attack the businesses that benefit from ultra-low interest rates as opposed to the central banks themselves.
It's funny you mention that, because I've found during this recent, all these recent protests during the most recent BLM movement, but particularly during COVID, because COVID has really just accelerated what was already happening. And how many businesses, particularly your Amazons of the world, are pro this topic of racial divide, but as soon as you start talking about wages, it's all hush hush. Like, I find
that. In fairness, they raised their minimum wage more than they had to, though, Amazon.
Yes. So, but it, at large, if you're looking at a group of people who are these larger corporations and the way that they preserve their image, you can sort of see, and this is, I guess, a meme that pervades on economic or economic Twitter, is that it's really what has happened is a distraction for inequality, like actual inequality, which is monetary inequality, which is what Jordan Peterson talks about a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I follow Amazon a bit because Bezos is just the most brilliant businessman we've seen. It doesn't mean his business isn't doing a huge amount of economic damage to mum and dad type small businesses. And I suspect he will get broken up, not because he's evil, but because he's just too good at business and he is going to ruin so many small operators. But I sort of look at his letter, like for years, Warren Buffett's letters to investors that he'd write annually was sort of, you know, something that all investors or anyone interested in finance really had to read. I think it sort of gave clues to what's coming next. I feel like Bezos's annual letter to his shareholders has almost replaced that now.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting, A, that they did raise minimum wage more than they had to. I think they might have raised it by 8%, which is material. And talked a lot about other ESG thematics. There was a lot about carbon footprint, reducing that. I thought it was a clear pathway to what some of the big pain points are going to be in the next 3 to 5 years for those large corporations, because the biggest risk to companies like Amazon is that they get split up. And I think they probably will. You know, what's happened to Standard Oil at the turn of the century, when Rockefeller was just getting too big and too powerful.
The antitrust campaign. I just finished the Rockefeller book. Who wrote it? I think it was Walter Isaacson.
Okay.
But pardon?
Is it a good read?
It's very interesting. I mean, the guy came from nothing. It's just one of the most remarkable stories. And he was not a particularly special individual when it came to intelligence or anything of the like. He actually had a really tough upbringing in terms of the family situation. His dad was essentially just a wanderer. So he's really just brought up by his mother in the early 1800s, very, very early 1800s.
It's going to be a huge catch 22 with that breakup, though, because I think for all intents and purposes, when companies get too big and powerful, and you're really looking at, you know, Amazon, Google, Facebook, they're probably the ones that stand out off the top of my head that are in line for a potential breakup. That's what's happened in the past, but we're also in a phase where there's a potential Cold War emerging between China and the US, which is really going to be fought out through tech. So it doesn't make sense to weaken your tech industry when, in a way, they're really going to be at the front line of any wars going forward. And we're seeing the beginnings of potentially a Cold War between those two superpowers. Let's hope it doesn't get into a hot war, but that's going to be the big arm wrestle and big debate. Do you weaken big tech when they're so important to national security, but they're also decimating so many smaller operators at the same time?
Yeah, let's. I want to jump back to China and COVID because that's a very interesting thing. We just had the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, in the last week do a bunch of announcements around what the future of the economy looks like and that whole supply chain. So I want to get into that, but I've got to ask, with your own investing principles, if we fast forward to Chris post career. And talking your own book, I guess, I get a sense that there's been a few references to Charlie Munger. I'm a fan of Munger. I don't know if you own Berkshire shares, like a lot of us sort of disciples. But I would say I would agree. I think the Bezos letter and the Munger letter each year are sort of two must reads. I know through my own research, you built this idea around the importance of relationships with Nigel Slattery. You got an understanding of structure and probably integration from Pratt and the Pratt Industries business, and then deal flow from Tony. I know you've got, it sort of seems like you've had some VC type investments, microcap type investments. Do you define yourself in any way as a growth or value-based investor?
No, I don't. And people are so quick to try and label you in a different category. And they are in just wider life as well. But the risk is then those rules you set for yourself when you say this is what I am, is they can become like a jail because investing is a game where the rules are constantly changing. You know, a lot of people, really smart people, thought negative interest rates were impossible. Then all of a sudden they appeared and there's trillions of dollars around the world priced with a negative interest rate. So, I mean, my ideal setup is to be in companies with long macro tailwinds in the industry they're in. And I like smaller companies because the person who's on the other side of the transaction is less sophisticated than when you're buying into big companies and it's an institutional investor on the other side of the transaction. So that's the basic setup. But I mean, I've founded a private business or private businesses before that would be more akin to sort of startup or PE investing, a little bit of venture capital type investing, which I find hard in Australia. But the main focus is on public equities, and the main ideas come through macroeconomic research.
Okay. And do you find that there are ever, like I find for myself, there are key things that I'm always looking for. Like I have a preference. You said before you prefer microcap stocks that really have a sort of tailwind going behind them. And there's a lot of upside there. I think for myself, I'd probably agree, but I also heavily look at cash flow, whether I understand the business or not. And if it's an industry that I really get, like I have very specific industries that I invest in and they're quite limited. Do you have anything like that where, you know, you might have a focus on biotech or tech or fintech or finance, or is there anything like that that you impose on yourself?
No, it's really focusing on big macroeconomic issues. So some of them would be around the issues with fiat currency when you've got central banks debasing fiat currencies as they are right around the world, aging demographics in the Western world, which is a really easy long-term trend to predict. Automation, robotics, or the digitization of the world is another sort of long-term thematic. Clean air, particularly in China, is a long-term thematic, and that's a little bit different to climate change. And so I'm not interested in investing in electric vehicle manufacturers, but certainly the minerals that are needed for those EVs, you know, particularly things like cobalt, copper, nickel, I find interesting, less so lithium because it's more readily available. So that's the start. And then I get lots of opportunities sent through from a broker network of sort of 15 to 20 different brokers each day. And sometimes they'll be worth exploring. And, you know, a lot of my day is spent either reading or sitting down with companies listening to investment presentations, usually when they're trying to raise capital. So most of the investments come about through capital raisings.
Yeah, that's what I was one of the things I was thinking about is what would his process be? I'd imagine a lot of it would be reading.
Yeah.
I know for myself, I'll focus on certain industries and scan opportunities across the world. Then I'll just read everything I possibly can on that business and the people involved in it. If you look at your day today, is that sort of your approach? If you were to split it up into percentages, are you reading for like 40-50% of the day, going through Twitter, you do your interviews? How does that sort of look for you at the moment?
Yeah, most of the day is spent reading. So there'd be about 5 or 6 hours a day reading. And some of that's just through content consumption as well. So that might be whether it's listening to podcasts or, you know, there's video content made on platforms like Real Vision that's just exceptional. So call it 5 to 6 hours a day of content consumption, and then the rest of the time is spent speaking to the network and really creating a heuristic, because there's too many companies to go through one by one. But if you know the people that are introducing them, and you can rank and understand their quality, and then that can lead into the heuristic of understanding the quality of the management involved with that company. So that's the challenge. How do you scan as a one-man band, not miss too many great opportunities, but not spend too much time exploring average opportunities?
How are you then condensing that info? Like, you know, if you read 5-6 hours a day, you know, you'd have your time decompressing at night, but I imagine there would be certain themes, certain ideas that would stick out amongst that reading over time, whether it's a week or a month or whatever. Some of them you probably talk about on your podcasts. Do you journal or anything like that, where you really like to put pen to paper on certain trends that you're seeing?
No, not in that form. That's just being constantly aware of what's going on and just watching and listening. And there's reading, but there's also taking note of what the markets are telling you as well, which is a really important factor. Particularly, you know, there might be a price of an asset or a stock, but let's call it an asset more broadly. And, you know, the gold price has been strong. I won't say everyone thought it was going to be strong. A lot of people did. Yeah. So I don't think that gives you a huge amount of information. If you've got gold or gold shares, it's pleasant. But what can give you a lot of information is when something happens that nobody's expecting. And, you know, there's some of the things that I try and look out for and to think about what that might be telling us. So, for instance, after the March or April crash from COVID,
yeah,
we then had a really sharp reversal in asset prices in listed equities all around the world. And that was unexpected. That wasn't consensus, really. I mean, I know if stock prices are going up, clearly there's more interest in buying them than selling them. But it certainly wasn't a consensus view. And so it's interesting, what did that tell us about what's potentially coming? And I think what it told us is that, you know, if you've got a good economic environment and markets are stable and growth is, call it, you know, 1.5-2%, and inflation, call it, is about the same, that's nirvana. That's when things are going really smoothly. Then you've got left tail risk, which is depreciating asset prices, depression. And then you've got right tail risk, which is really high inflation. And right, it's really easy to understand what the left tail risk feels like. You can understand, if you own a house, what it feels like if that value dropped by 50% and the bank says you've got negative equity, you've got to sell your house. That's very easy to understand what that feels like. I don't think it's as easy for everyone to understand what that right tail risk feels like, largely because we've been in a pretty benign inflation environment since the early 80s, and bond prices will tell you that. But it feels good at the start. You know, it feels good at the start. There's inflation. People who have a job start getting paid a bit more. Asset prices go up. But then if it's not accompanied by economic growth and you have a large number of people unemployed and things aren't going up by a value of 2% a year but 6% a year, or, you know, we've seen cases in Zimbabwe where a loaf of bread costs double the amount in the afternoon as it did in the morning, it doesn't feel so good. Now, clearly, we're not going to be Zimbabwe and neither is the US, but I think that right tail risk around higher inflation has potentially been a clue what the markets have been telling us since an appreciation that very few expected, particularly as rapidly as it has been. So it could be right, it could be wrong, but looking out for what the markets are signalling and trying to tell you is a really important part of being an investor as well.
Yeah, and trying to marry that up with, I totally understand what you're saying. We're trying to marry up what the market is saying and what the business environment is doing. That's sort of the hardest part, I would say. And in March, well,
I just think they're very, now that's not too bad, because the markets aren't the economy. Stock market is just not the economy. It's about people's perception of what the future looks like. The bond market really is the economy, or much closer to it, you know, and you'll see bond prices appreciate when economic environment is bad. But I think conflating the bond, the stock market with the economy is where people can get into a bit of trouble as well.
Yeah. What I'm saying is understanding the key differences between them and how it affects businesses in the long run. Because at the end of the day, you're totally right. Like Apple stock is very different to Apple, the company, but there's also the issue that when you have a stock that big or any stock in general, the executives of the company have got to signal to the market what's happening. And it's really hard particularly at the moment. Like that's why I found March so interesting, because I saw March as an opportunity to get at some opportunities that may not have existed without COVID. Even if the economy goes as we expect it, as it's come out in the data, particularly with how bad things have gone, there was still a lot of opportunity there. But I never expected the market to come back up as quickly as it did. Like I didn't think that I would be selling out of some of those opportunities, or at least taking some gains in this financial year at all.
No, it was incredible. And it was so quick. Like I was lucky enough to buy a few things during all that carnage. I bought a bit of gold. I was confident in gold. But things like City Chic dropped and I bought some, but I punched them out early, you know. Yeah. And I reckon I bought Adairs, but I punched that out very early too, because I didn't have any conviction that it was going to last, and I had no idea that it was going to remain, I mean, as strong as it has. So that was the bit that has surprised me, just how sustained it's been. The retailers, I'm still not convinced. You know, everyone's had a pay rise on average. People are taking home more money than they were pre-COVID, just to the huge amounts of government stimulus. Hmm. And that really all runs out in March. You know, people have redrawn on their super. They've been able to stop paying their mortgage if they wanted to. There's been a huge amount of government money going to individuals and businesses. And those things are gradually starting to wear off now. And by March, they will have worn off. So it'll be interesting to see if a lot of those retailers, you know, JB Hi-Fi and Adairs and Premier, that have done brilliantly, if that demand has been essentially brought forward and the extra money's made it easier for the consumer to buy those goods, or if it is a longer-term sort of sustained rally in those stocks. That's going to be interesting to watch. And one I haven't got a clear view myself on, but it's going to be an interesting time around March and April to see how those companies respond.
Yeah, I think March is going to be very interesting. You mentioned before, really a lot of local businesses, a lot of the... When I think about my own trading, I'd say like 80% of it is international shares. Do you give much consideration to that at all, or do you solely focus on the home economy?
I just focus on Aussie stocks. I think I just want to try and build out some sort of advantage as an investor, and focusing on Australian stocks, particularly small ones, I'm in a position where I can be able to meet management and see the whites of their eyes, get a greater understanding of what they're doing. And I feel in that aspect, I'd be at a real disadvantage to be investing in international stocks, because there'd be some guy or girl living overseas investing in that stock, and I'd be buying their shares, or I'd be selling my shares to them. And if they've got access to the CEO and they live in that environment, I think they'd have an advantage. So I generally try and avoid international stocks. I've got some things that have been listed on the Canadian Stock Exchange, because that's how it transpired. But yeah, my real focus is on Aussie equities.
Chris Judd Invest, you mentioned or referenced before Real Vision. I get a sense that you're really inspired by brands like that when it comes to the creation of this brand in particular. There's two different podcasts that extend from that, Talk Your Book and Masters of the Markets as well. I can sort of see how it made a lot of sense. You're doing special comments in AFL. You get into this investing thing and realize that there is, in a lot of ways in different areas, a lack of commentary in the market here in Australia. But I could also see how you would look at it and go, well, for me, it would just make more sense to build my now as an investor get access to people that ordinarily may not say yes for various reasons. What was sort of the aha moment to create Chris Judd Invest?
Well, you're right. So, I mean, Real Vision is just brilliant. And things like Real Vision or Grant Williams is things that make you go, or, you know, whether it's Macro Voices or Kevin Muir is brilliant, Kirill Sokoloff, you know, the list goes on. But particularly probably Real Vision, it's just made such a material difference to my life. You know, it's given me the ability to get up and work each day on something that I really enjoy, but given me the ability for that to be a success. So I saw how important that was to me. And then I saw in Australia, there's just not a huge amount of finance content created. We had Sky Business and that closed down.
Yeah.
So for those interested in the local market, I think there's a good offering, you know, sort of financial planning advice for people looking to get into that space. But for maybe someone who's a bit beyond, you know, lessons around savings and things like that and wants a little bit more sophistication, there just weren't a lot of offerings. And I guess noting that and also being aware that I'm in a phase in my career where I should be working for someone else and learning off people with grey hairs and all the rest. But that's not something I wanted to do. So to be able to get access to some great investors around Australia who have brilliant lessons to share, to be able to do that for me to pick up and learn off their different investing styles or their investment frameworks that they use, just felt like a really good opportunity. And it's been well received. I've been lucky to meet a lot of different investors who've been generous with their time. And I'm not sure where it's going to end up. I haven't come into it with a 10-year plan of world domination. And, you know, I don't think Bezos is at any risk that it's going to take over the world and do any damage to Amazon, for instance. But for me, it's been a great journey. I got to meet some great people. And when you are a private investor, it can be a pretty lonely profession. You know, your wins, you celebrate by yourself. Your losses, you whinge about to yourself. So to have that human element has been something that I've enjoyed as well.
Yeah, there's some really good interviews in there. We've interviewed Alex Saunders in the past. I saw he was in there.
He was great. Yeah.
Yeah. He's a good guy. Very good. Probably one of the few educators in that space that is not there to make a dime off others at the moment. But
he's not a spruiker. Yeah. Twitter's full of different spruikers.
That's the right term.
And I don't mind that. It's a bit like I like the horse races, and you go there and there's people from all different walks of life and they're all working an angle, and their idea is they want to have a little bit of escapism and make some money. And markets are a bit the same. You've got some unsophisticated people working an angle and you've got some really sophisticated investors, and everyone's somewhere on that continuum. I think as long as you know where each actor sits in that continuum, then you don't run into too much trouble.
What's been the biggest difference you've noticed between AFL and finance media?
In terms of the actual working in them or?
Well, not so much working in them. It could be any insight, really. It could be the best and worst thing about it, but there's a difference in tone of the types of media. Like I noticed in AFL media, everyone's looking for the quick hot take.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Well, I guess even AFL media, it's so different across the spectrum. You know, I mean, I work on Triple M and, you know, Damien Barrett has some breaking news stories, but by and large, we're not chasing a hot take. It's a different spectrum. I think what I've learned in media is it's enjoyable when you're fulfilling a role that's really aligned to who you are.
Mm.
And then you can be yourself and it all flows. If you're a really serious type media operator and you're asked to be on a program that's built around humor, it just doesn't work out in the long run. And vice versa, if you view the game as something that's fun and not curing cancer, it doesn't make sense to be promulgating a high amount of seriousness regarding the game. So I think that's been a bit of a learning with media. you need to find a form that fits your personality and how you view the world. And I think that's probably true across all media. You know, if you can't be your authentic self, it's not going to work out in the long run.
Let's jump to China, the economy and COVID. In this take, you could say I'm looking for a hot take, but
I appreciate being warned. I appreciate being warned before I launch into anything. That's good.
But I'm really trying to get a set. Like, I have struggled, I think, in the last, let's say the last 2 to 3 weeks, I've really struggled to get a sense as to where things are going. And I think really where things are going at the moment is just continued uncertainty. It's hard to make decisions about what is actually happening. I mean, I run a creative agency on top of this podcast with my partner. We've got staff. We were looking at moving spaces probably May, June, and I'm so thankful that we didn't. And it's just getting harder and harder to get an idea as to what the next 6 to 12 months looks like. And so we've had to be quite conservative and very risk averse in decisions that we make around the business and just life in general. So I guess I'm curious, how are you looking at the next 6 to 12 months? What's certain and uncertain to you?
Well, unfortunately, it's all uncertain. It'd be much better if it was certain. But as an investor, your job is to weigh the probabilities of what you think the future is going to look like. And I think it's important too, so often in media now, the future gets spoken about in certainties, or and football's the same. You know, a player is either the best ever, going to be the best ever, or is finished. One of three things. And in reality, players are never really any of those things. They're always pretty good or pretty bad or improving or having a bad day, or, you know, this idea that everything is always an extremity is a bit alarmist. And so I guess I say that with the China situation currently and the geopolitical relations between China and the US, and Australia has been bundled into that as well. And I don't think globalization is finished, but I think the halcyon days are potentially over, and there'll still be things manufactured in different parts of the world and distributed to other countries. But I mean, I think there are going to be trade alliances with groups of nations, and I suspect the internet will end up getting split up between a US internet and a China internet. And we're seeing the early stages of that with what the US have done with TikTok, and we know that China's not open to companies like Facebook and Google, and essentially their internet's closed when compared to the US's. So I think that's going to grow and continue to grow. And I think Australia will trade more freely with countries like, you know, the US, Canada, maybe India, the UK.
So have you read much? Have you read much then on Kanzik? Because I've noticed that with the recent discussions around the free trade agreement with the UK, this idea of Kanzik or Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and the UK expanding, having a wide-ranging free trade agreement is sort of gathering pace on Twitter.
Yeah, I haven't read extensively about it, but you can see it happening. We've obviously seen tariffs being introduced in the US against China and some other countries as well. So I think that feels like it's coming. I feel like we've even seen China in some of the stashes with Australia recently claim that Treasury wine estates were dumping wine on their market with artificially low prices. And so it feels like this whole thematic is going to continue to grow. I sort of feel like maybe some agricultural companies are more vulnerable there. You know, I'd be a bit nervous about some of the milk providers potentially, because it feels like China could get that milk and those infant formula products elsewhere. Whereas something like if you're a copper producer, I can't see China ratcheting up the price of copper by saying we're not going to buy your copper from Australia. So there's certain industries which, even though they rely very heavily on on Chinese imports, I feel have a bit more strength because it doesn't make sense for China to cut their nose to spite their face. I guess as an Australian, we hope, well, I hope it just doesn't escalate more than it has to. I mean, obviously, we don't want interference in, you know, our politics from foreign countries, but I think there's a balancing act between respecting the important roles China's played with Australia as well in terms of their number one trading partner by a country mile. And so there's some sort of balancing act that needs to be reached there between respecting our number one customer but also keeping, you know, safe Australia and Australian way of life for generations to come.
It sort of sounds like the way that you're talking about it and others have spoken about it is it's going to be these discussions around China are going to be siloed into different areas of the supply chain, whether it's primary industries, manufacturing, wholesale trade or distribution, and there will be different impacts on different areas. And then each thing will be segmented down into different components as well, whether it's copper versus iron ore or milk versus beef, as an example. It was interesting seeing in the AFR recently, the AFR loves to stir shit up, but, you know, talking about Chinese diplomats approaching Brazilian diplomats around ramping up and investing in iron ore deposits. So you can sort of see how that may be permeating through the supply chain. I think going back to your point about globalization, everyone keeps talking about this whole idea of localization.
Yeah.
Where a lot of your manufacturing and distribution is a lot closer to the base of where it gets distributed to. But we'll see. Because, I mean, like, just before this, I'm pretty sure a lot of the major companies in the supply chain space, mining and so forth, were over in Vietnam with the Prime Minister's office for a major event with, you know, their diplomats talking about supply chains. So you could sort of see how, as well, it would just be easier to move a lot of what is done in China into Vietnam.
So, and I think that's likely that there will be some manufacturing move there. There'll be some stuff that goes to South Korea. There'll be some that stays in China. But I mean, I think that localization is a trend that's here to stay, but it's not appropriate for everything.
Yeah.
There'll be also things that are just issues of national security. Like, I mean, I think all countries are now aware that 90% of the antibiotics get manufactured in China, and that's a big security risk. And yeah. You know, I think you'll get a lot of onshoring of antibiotics and medical products coming back to the US and to countries like Australia as well, so that if there is a hot war at some stage or something else unforeseen, that our supply chains aren't as exposed as probably what they are today.
Yeah, the idea of a primary industry may become expanded other than just milk and beef. May include the other things that you actually need to survive a hot war. Before I jump into some rapid fire questions to finish off, I've got to ask, I think both you and your partner, Beck, people that, or as a couple, my partner and I have looked up to, just respective, looking at the two of you, you've done, been able to do your own things in your own way. You know, various different businesses, whether it's media commentary, investing and so forth. And she's obviously been quite successful in her own right. I was curious, what have you learned from her in your time together?
She's hyper organized, Beck.
Mm-hmm. What does hyper mean?
Extremely. As a Jordan Peterson fan, you should understand the use of hyper. His hyper confident line is a very regular one. She's incredibly well organized, really smart, but very driven to achieve the next thing. She doesn't like standing still and is always looking towards the next thing. So I think I've learned that. I've learned a lot about being a parent from her. She's a great teacher to our kids and very patient with them. So, I'm sort of pretty laissez-faire with the kids in terms of homework and things like that. So having someone who's a bit more focused and pushing them in those areas has been, you know, very good for our family as well.
Rapid fire questions. What does your morning routine look like?
get up at six, okay, and I get about an hour of that content in that we'd speak about. So I get on, I'll check a few different prices on Think Markets, and I'll check a few things on Twitter, and then I'll usually listen to some, I'll usually go to the gym and do a bit of a workout whilst listening to a different podcast or Real Vision.
What's been your top three podcasts of choice recently?
Well, it's not a podcast, but in terms of newsletter, Kevin Muir's newsletter is just brilliant. The Macro Tourist and Value for Money, it is cheap as chips. It is, I think it's about $200 or $300 for the year. He comes out with two or three articles a week and they're good, and he is a ripper. The End Game for Grant Williams is up there, and Macro Voices is a stable. That's a really good, solid podcast that I've enjoyed for a long number of time.
Years. Yeah, Grant Williams is an absolute classic. Grant's Interest Rate Observer also, I remember reading that way back in the day. I can't remember the last time I looked at that. If you were to sort of identify a purchase that's under $200, and it could have been during or before this whole period, and it's been quite useful during lockdown, what would it be and why?
I feel drawn to say coffee beans, but maybe there should be something more significant.
Hey, a lot of people talk about AirPods.
No, I don't like them. Nah.
You don't like them, yeah.
Nah, I'm on the old school. I want the string attached. I had I had a run-in with the AirPods doing an interview where they ran out mid-interview, and since then I just want the old school string. So actually, you know what? That's probably been these very earphones I'm using, bought from a service station, have been a huge help for my my podcast because the sound's been a lot better. So I'm going to go with them.
Very good. Look, Chris, thanks for doing this, mate. It's been a while since we originally organised this, but where can people find you on the interwebs?
At Chris Judd Invest. So there's a website, chrisjuddinvest.com, or YouTube channel, Chris Judd Invest, probably the best places to check out the content.
Beautiful. We'll link all of that. But Chris, thanks once again.
Thanks, Jordan. Appreciate it. It's good fun.
Thanks for listening in to this episode. If you like it, do leave us a written review on your podcast app, as it helps us continue going on a weekly basis, and we do love reading those reviews as well. If you want the show notes, you can find that below, or with our previous guest at neural.com/podcast. That's neural.com/podcast. To watch the full video, search Uncommon Show on YouTube, and to keep up to date with behind the scenes and clips for the show, you can find us at uncommon_show on Instagram. But until next time, guys, thank you so much for listening.